Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the programme, France produces an alternative to Starlink. Macedonia mourns the victims of a deadly nightclub fire.
Everybody know everybody. And we know a member of the family who lost their children now, and we are all sad. We don't know what to say. Maybe I will say something, but after 7 days, because we have 7 days for respect for our people who lost their life.
Germany tears up the rulebook on austerity, and Czechia produces the longest tram in the world. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. In a recent exchange between Elon Musk and the Polish foreign minister, the American entrepreneur seemed to threaten to shut down Ukraine's use of his Starlink satellite communications system. Musk quickly issued a statement saying that he would never do this, but given the uncertainty surrounding US policy towards Ukraine since Donald Trump returned to the White House, Europe is examining its options and believes that it has an alternative. John Lawrenson filed this report from Paris.
After Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, plunging Europe into its bloodiest armed conflict since Germany invaded Poland in 1939, it immediately destroyed Ukraine's communications network. It was a huge blow, disrupting communication inside the Ukrainian army, but also because modern weapon systems, attack drones, for example, need the internet to find their targets. Elon Musk's response was quick and decisive. He rushed thousands of terminals to Ukraine so the country and its armed forces could use his Starlink satellite communication system. This aid was, as the entrepreneur himself said, crucial.
Starlink did play a pivotal role because Russia had actually taken out all of the satellite communications and all of the ground communications except for Starlink. It was the only one that was still operating. And even today, it is still the only one that is effective at the front lines. And Starlink today is the backbone of the Ukrainian military communications.
During his recent Tetchi exchange with the Polish foreign minister, during which Musk called the minister a small man, the multi-billionaire claimed there is no alternative to Starlink, but Europeans beg to differ. Hervé Bernecke is the director of the French satellite communications company Eutelsat.
Pour Ukraine, en fait, début de la crise en Ukraine.
From the start of the Ukrainian war, we were supplying satellite communications capacity to European companies who provided Ukraine with terminals. This conflict shows clearly how important satellite communications have become on the battlefield. Indeed, I believe the very first act of war was the hacking of the Ukrainian satellite communication system. It is clear that Starlink satellite communications, but also ours, although people talk about it less, is essential when it comes to troop movements, but also for the civilian population with the mobile telephone networks out of action.
The difference in capacity between Eutelsat and Starlink looks very big on paper. Elon Musk's company has 6,000 satellites in low orbit, Eutelsat 634. But, says Bernecke, the French firm could replace Starlink in Ukraine.
Our satellites do the same job. We have the same global coverage with our 600 satellites. The big difference is that we orbit higher at 1,200 kilometers, while they're at 400 kilometers. So, very simply, you need a lot more satellites when you're orbiting closer to Earth. We cover the same places, Ukraine, the neighboring countries, and indeed the whole world. We don't have the same quantity of capacity, but when it comes to Ukraine, it's not necessarily the quantity that matters. It's above all about having secure coverage that covers the whole territory, even when the electricity is down. That's important.
Eva Bernecke says discussions are underway about taking a more important role in Ukraine.
Aujourd'hui, c'est clair que ces discussions-là sont identifiées.
Those discussions are taking place, above all, over the number of terminals in Ukraine. We have supplied hundreds, even thousands of terminals. In other words, antennas on the ground that people can use. Now, we are looking at how we could radically increase that number so that if Starlink unplugs, they'll have a backup.
The value of Eutelsat's stock has increased by around 400% since the start of the month, with the prospect of increased European government defence spending and an increased role in Ukraine. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Elon Musk's Starlink, by the way, is currently a privately owned company, so I don't have any figures for comparison there, but I can tell you that SpaceX is now the billionaire's most profitable asset, following a massive slump in the value of Tesla shares. Now, time to shift our focus to North Macedonia, which this week is a country in mourning. Last Sunday, almost 60 people, most of them young, died in a nightclub fire in the small town of Kocani. Scores more remain in hospital. And mixed in with the grief, there's anger too, with people holding endemic corruption responsible for the disaster. Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, was in Kocani and sent us this report.
Kocani is mourning its dead. It's no exaggeration to say that the dozens of young people who died at the Pulse nightclub were the future of this small town. Just 25,000 people live here, around 100 kilometres to the east of the capital, Skopje, and a total of more than 200 were either killed or injured when sparks from onstage pyrotechnics started a fire on the ceiling of the venue. So there's barely a household here that hasn't been affected.
This is a small city, and we don't have this in history. This is a catastrophe, and like a small city, we don't know what to do in this situation.
I met Zoran Todorov at a vigil in Kocani's Central Park the evening after the disaster.
We try to help to family who lost their children. We try to be one big family and make some things who will be good for this city in this moment.
Kocani is a small town, so every family must be affected.
Everybody know everybody. And we know a member of that family who lost their children now, and we are all sad. We don't know what to say. Maybe I will say something, but after 7 days, because we have 7 days for respect for our people who lost their life.
It's the day after the disaster, and we're back in Kocani's small central park. This started as a vigil, but now there's a strong element of protest. There are thousands of people here, among them large groups of teenagers holding signs bearing the names of the friends and family members they've lost. There are also strong words directed towards the authorities, intolerable, corruption, and, most of all, justice. It didn't take long for the mood to shift from grief to anger. As the rain started to fall, the crowd set off from the park to march around the town. They passed a cafe with the same owner as Club Pulse, and some young people saw a chance to exact justice in a destructive fashion. The anger comes from the knowledge that Pulse had an operating license, even though it was a converted carpet warehouse without fire exits or a sprinkler system. It also had a highly flammable ceiling. People have drawn their own conclusions and put the blame on corruption. North Macedonia is a country where having connections or greasing the right palms takes precedence over public safety. Venko Korstevsky is one of the survivors of the fire.
The culprits must be named. We who survived in the nightclub, if we stay here, we will continue to die every day. We're dying because of polluted air. We're dying because of irresponsible institutions. We're dying because of corruption. We're dying because of all the dysfunctions created by politicians and the institutions they run.
This gathering in Skopje's main square drew thousands of people to pay their respects, but also to call for justice. Similar shows of support and anger have been held across the country. People tell me they're looking to neighbouring Serbia as an example. A disaster there triggered a massive anti-corruption movement that's prompted the Prime Minister's resignation and put the government under serious pressure. North Macedonia may see a similar movement if the authorities don't take convincing measures. For the moment, Prime Minister Hristijan Mitsotakis is talking tough.
We will have no mercy. I said that yesterday and I will repeat it today. Regardless of who that someone is, regardless of their ethnicity and regardless of which political party they are, what has happened was worse than a crime. This was, I would say, a mass murder allowed to happen by someone for money, for bribes, for corruption.
The government's problem is that it's part of the system that North Macedonia's people hold responsible for the disaster in Kocheni. They can't simply blame it on former officials who are members of other parties, which is what they've been doing so far. The fire has sparked real anger, and it seems likely that only meaningful change will put that out. Guy Delaunay, DW, Kocheni.
Grief as a catalyst for change. There will be echoes of that theme in the second half of the programme when we'll be looking at the protest movement sparked by Serbia's Novi Sad train disaster. For now, though, it's time for us to bring the programme back home to Germany, where it has been another historic week in Parliament. To put it simply, at the instigation of presumed Chancellor-in-waiting Friedrich Merz, the outgoing Parliament has just voted through a multi-billion euro package loosening borrowing limits and allowing new investments in defence, infrastructure and climate. This is a paradigm shift on two separate levels. On the one hand, it represents an unprecedented commitment to military spending, a shifting of the economy towards what some economists are describing as German military Keynesianism. On the other hand, it effectively rips up the rulebook on austerity. And the fact that it is Friedrich Merz, the leader of the CDU party, who is doing that, is really significant. Here's my conversation with our political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow.
Absolutely, because it was the CDU under Angela Merkel that specifically pressed for this fiscal responsibility for the so-called debt brake, which is part of Germany's constitution, which strictly limited the amount that Germany could borrow. And the fact that now Friedrich Merz, who's the chancellor in waiting, changed that and actually supported this massive political change is very significant. Friedrich Merz has been accused and criticized of making a U-turn in this because during the political campaign ahead of the elections, he was actually in favor of keeping this debt brake and of finding other ways to look for money in order for Germany to meet its responsibilities, both in terms of defense and on infrastructure. But now, this U-turn, he's defending it by saying that the political reality around the world, especially when it comes to Donald Trump and his policies in the US, especially when it comes to basically Europe not being able to always count on the US help, means that he has to change policy and that he has to look for these possibilities when it comes to boosting Germany's defense and increasing Germany's infrastructure. And when we talk about defense, we're not only speaking here about buying weapons. Obviously, that's one important element. But it's also about military aid to Ukraine, which for this year will be around 4 billion euros. It also means modernizing the intelligence services. It also means protecting IT systems. It means civil defense. So there's sort of a very broad understanding of what defense means in this particular context.
Right. And I mean, what are the sums that we're talking about? What kind of money is on the table?
Well, that's actually interesting because specifically when it comes to defense spending, the rule now says that defense spending that exceeds 1% of GDP will be exempted from these strict measures related to the debt brake. That, in clear words, basically means that Friedrich Merz has a blank check that he can use, if necessary, to increase Germany's defense spending. So that basically gives you an idea of the amounts that we're talking to. And it's not only about Germany, by the way, because if you look at this also from a European perspective, Ursula von der Leyen, who's the president of the European Commission, has set out proposals that could see up to 800 billion euros poured into the defense sector over the next few years. There's a whole discussion at the European level about potentially borrowing money together or accruing different kind of defense capabilities for the bloc as such, a topic that is very controversial and that we're not going to specifically focus on now. But we're talking about really very big sums when it comes to defense spending. And in the case of Germany, this is being described as a blank check that basically the Chancellor in waiting, Friedrich Merz, now has and that he can use to increase Germany's defense capabilities.
Yeah, and it really does sort of feel that this is a moment in which the existential crisis posed by this new geopolitical conjuncture that we seem to be in, certainly since J.D. Vance's appearance at the Munich Security Conference, that the urgency there is enabling the German government to, at the same time, address slow burn existential crises like infrastructure, like the climate crisis, that before there seemed to have been gridlock on. So, I mean, this sort of sense that we're in this sort of incredibly frightening, but also sort of exciting in many ways time when there is so much sort of possibility. Things that seemed politically impossible have suddenly become possible. And Friedrich Merz seems to be a man who has understood this and who is prepared to take bold steps that represent a major departure with his own political past in order to do what he believes to be the right thing in this particular moment of time.
There are those who are criticizing Friedrich Merz for his political U-turn, saying that he has compromised his own political credibility by making these U-turns. That's a criticism that you hear from the far right. There are others who say that Friedrich Merz has been pragmatic in his decisions and that this latest move is essentially a pragmatic decision also in order for him, when he becomes chancellor, to have the necessary resources to put in practice all the different proposals that he has and the coalition agreement that is now being discussed. So there are different views on Friedrich Merz, but the fact that he has basically a blank check to spend on defense plus a whole amount of money to boost Germany's economy does mean that there's a lot of potential, but also a lot of risk, because this is not simply money that Germany has received as a present. This is money that Germany is borrowing and that they will have to pay back. So that's why there's also certain concern among those who think that this is ultimately a burden that is going to be carried by future generations and that Germany will see the problems, probably not now, but maybe in the future. But I do agree that these times are in one way very interesting, in other ways also very challenging. It's unclear how important international developments will change from the war in Ukraine to the relationship between European countries and the United States under Donald Trump. These are all issues that the next government will have to deal with. And by Friedrich Merz's proposal here, and by the fact that it was approved by the two-thirds of the German parliament, it basically means that he can guarantee the money that he needs to put his policies into practice. Had parliament voted against this, it would have basically meant that Friedrich Merz would become a chancellor without any funds. And on this point, very briefly, it's important to mention that because it's a change to Germany's constitution, this is something that must not only be approved by the Bundestag, but also by the Bundesrat. So basically where the 16 regional states sit. And that's something that's going to happen at the end of this week.
Our political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow, there speaking to me from Berlin. Here in Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock, and you're listening to Inside Europe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the host of Marketplace, your daily download on the economy. Money influences so much of what we do and how we live. That's why it's essential to understand how this economy works. At Marketplace, we break down everything from inflation and student loans to the future of AI so that you can understand what it all means for you. Marketplace is your secret weapon for understanding this economy. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Given that Germany has all this new capacity for infrastructure spending, I wonder where all the contracts will be going. I'm asking because the German cities of Mannheim, Heidelberg and Ludwigshafen are about to get something of a technological first, the longest tram in the world. It's nearly 60 metres long and, crucially, will travel not just around the cities, but in between them too. Surprisingly, though, it wasn't built in Germany. The tram has been made by the Skoda Group in Pilsen in the Czech Republic, from where Rob Cameron sent us this report.
A ride along the test track at Skoda Transportation, a large industrial facility in the historic city of Pilsen in West Bohemia, the city that brought you lager and a lot of heavy engineering, including trains and trams. This was a test drive for journalists of the brand new Skoda 4City Smart 38T tram, which will soon be heading to the veritable Rhine-Neckar Transport Authority, which serves the ancient cities of Mannheim and Heidelberg in Baden-Württemberg and Ludwigshafen in Rhineland-Palatinate. At 58.69 metres, it's longer than a blue whale, longer than a 737-400 series. In fact, the 38T is now officially the longest tram in the world. Kai Biebler, Chief Operating Officer of Skoda Group, is the project director.
Well, I must say I'm quite proud.
You and your colleagues have explained very well how versatile, how adaptable this system is. You can make it shorter, you can make it longer, it can be a tram that just runs in a city, it can connect two cities along standard rail lines.
Mm-hmm. Don't need overhead wires,
has the traction batteries on top.
Yes.
But do you think this is the future of sustainable transportation for built-up urban agglomerations that we have so many of in Europe?
I guess there's a clear market demand. Is not so costly. You can transport more than with buses. Also, studies show that the people like more to travel with trams than with buses. And so it can help to connect new growing cities with the center and the heart of bigger areas and metropole areas.
You might detect something of a German accent there, and I was curious as to the political sensitivities of a Czech-owned company providing transport solutions to a German metropolitan area at a time of increasing economic nationalism and worries over unemployment. Jan Christoph Harder is the president of Skoda Group's West and North region and, like Kai, is also German, but he says the city's reasons for choosing this tram were purely economic.
First of all, I think it's a very unpolitical reason. It's a reason just to have the right solution for the city, also to identify a supplier who is at a reasonable cost, delivering in reasonable time the material you need, because you have to solve a transportation issue. Of course, we see these trends coming up with a little bit more national things, and we are responding because we are growing our team in Germany.
Kai Biebler says even Skoda's founder, Emil Skoda, was a man of broad pan-European horizons.
Emil Skoda, who founded this company in 1869, he studied in Germany, in Stuttgart and Karlsruhe, mechanical engineering, was working then and got his first experience in locomotive building in the Richard Hartmann Works in Chemnitz. And so far it is in our DNA to collaborate internationally. And that we also will continue.
And as they point out, the 38T actually starts life in Otanmaki in Finland, where the bodies are produced before travelling here to be completed. Each one is a showcase of European engineering, with hundreds of thousands of parts sourced from 214 suppliers across the continent. Emil Skoda, I'm sure, would be proud. Rob Cameron, DW, Pilsen.
Please mind the gap when descending from the tram. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Still to come, national challenges to the nationalist agenda. As Orbán bids for transatlantic hegemony, Hungarians take to the streets. Meanwhile, in Serbia, President Vučić has less than 30 days to appoint a new prime minister or face new elections. Then, happy birthday, Thelma. Legendary performer Thelma Ruby turns 100, but this is no play. So, just what is she up to?
Actually, I love tennis. I go every year and sit in centre court and love watching it, which is why I'm so sad that I feel this way. You know, I really hate what they're doing and think that their plan is evil, but tennis itself I love.
All will be revealed at the end of the show. Now, anyone who has been following the social media handles of Elon Musk and related accounts will know that they appear to have been showing more than a passing interest in Europe recently. Well, the right-wing transatlantic interest is mutual. This week, the Polish investigative outlet V-Square revealed that the influential US think tank The Heritage Foundation is receiving proposals from illiberal forces in Poland and Hungary on how to shape the future of the European Union. The proposals obtained by V-Square include dismantling key EU institutions and renaming the entire bloc. Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, the longest-serving leader in the EU, is of course a key figure in transatlantic plans for what the proposals termed the Great Reset. However, at home, Orbán's grip on power is looking increasingly shaky, as two separate sets of demonstrations this week revealed. Our correspondent, Stefan Boss, attended both. Stefan, thanks for joining me. It's been a week of unrest in Hungary, so perhaps you could begin by telling me about the most recent of the demonstrations, which I believe was sparked by the banning of LGBTQ plus pride events.
It was really amazing what I saw. There was a huge police presence, several vehicles with sirens trying to block the people from crossing the Market Bridge, which is one of the main bridges in Budapest. They walked there because they were extremely angry that Hungary's right-wing government introduced a law that will ban the annual Pride March in support of the LGBTQ community. Now, while I was there, I spoke with several people. Some of them were really emotional when they heard the news, and this is what they said.
These people want to implement face recognition systems on the Pride. We are the guinea pigs. They're going to trial and try out these face recognition systems on us, and then once they perfected it, that's when they are going to actually implement on the rest of the Hungarians. But the Hungarians don't understand it, that it's just the beginning.
They try to raise the hate more. So, for example, this particular event, it's not only for Pride, it's for the law that you cannot express your opinion anymore. It's not only about the Pride, it's about freedom, that I can freely say that I not agree with something.
It was for me very interesting that also people who did not belong to the LGBTQ plus community, that they came there because they say it's a much broader issue. This is really about freedom of expression in Hungary today.
The LGBTQ plus solidarity demonstration, Stefan, was actually the second major demonstration in Hungary this week. The first was organized by the opposition. Could you tell me more about that?
Yes, indeed. What happened was that on Saturday, the March 15th, that's an annual holiday here commemorating Hungary's revolution against Habsburg rule, when Hungary was part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. This is always remembered. And on that day, tens of thousands of people braved the rain to rally in Budapest against Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, who also faces a growing public outrage over corruption allegations. There has been a list published with dozens and dozens of properties, including golf resorts and hotels that are in the hands of either his friends or family members. And people are outraged. Now, that is one of the reasons why people were protesting. Also, they were very angry about his pro-Russia policies. It was very interesting, this protest. It was actually led by Peter Magyar. He is a very prominent opposition figure. He used to be a government insider and only recently started a party. It's called the Tisza Party, named after Hungary's second largest river. And actually his party is leading in the polls. If there would be elections now, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban would actually lose the elections. So it's quite a significant situation, because it would mean that basically Hungary's longest ruling leader would actually lose the elections. And that's what we have not seen since 2010.
Well, indeed, Hungary's longest ruling leader, also the longest ruling leader in the EU. And for the first time in about 15 years, Viktor Orban's grip on power is being seriously challenged. And that's not just by protest movements on the streets. It's also by a serious, credible, oppositional challenge on a political level. And it's happening in the year before national elections are due to be held in 2026.
Indeed, that is what's happening now. And what is also very significant is that there are many people now behind one party. The problem with the opposition has been that it has been very fragmented. Quite honestly, there has been quite a lot of infighting among the different parties. But now you have one credible force, the Tisza party, that really could take on the ruling Fidesz party along with its much smaller Christian Democratic ally. Now, we can expect quite a big fight. What was worrying for opposition leaders is that the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that he will organize basically a crackdown on groups that he says have been funded through U.S. AID, the agency that the U.S. President Donald J. Trump basically wants to close or at least dramatically diminish. You have to know that in Hungary, a lot of media is in the hands of the ruling party. There are, of course, also independent media, but they really rely on private donations. So for them, it could get very difficult in the foreseeable future.
Stefan, would it be okay if I asked you a personal question? Because I'd like to ask how you're feeling about your own reporting in the lead up to the elections, because you are, I believe, still on a media blacklist.
Yes. Well, indeed, I'm one of the eight journalists that are still on the government-backed blacklist, which has been published by the 888.hu website, which has been funded by the government. We have been accused of being spokespersons of billionaire George Soros and of threatening the sovereignty of Hungary. You know, it shows us the paranoia, really, by the government towards independent journalists. And I think for me, it's not so much an issue. I think, you know, I'm a Dutch citizen. I can always escape. But if Hungarian journalists are threatened this way, it becomes, of course, a very big problem. Now, what is an issue is that there are preparations underway to actually expel people with a double nationality or a non-Hungarian nationality if they are seen as threatening the sovereignty of Hungary. And of course, that's a very broad interpretation. And what it could mean, according to critics, is really a crackdown on, for instance, critical media, as well as other groups that are then defined as a threat to Hungary. So it could get very interesting in the coming months, I think.
Our Budapest correspondent Stefan Boss there. And the theme of protest continues now as we move from Hungary to neighbouring Serbia. Is that the sound of a sound cannon being deployed against protesters in Belgrade last weekend? Serbian authorities say no. Over a million Serbs, however, have signed a petition calling for a swift investigation and an official probe by the United Nations. Meanwhile, Serbia's parliament has officially accepted the resignation of Prime Minister Milos Vucevic, triggering a 30-day deadline for the formation of a new government or the calling of snap elections. The unrest in Serbia was triggered by the collapse back in November of the roof of the Novi Sad train station and the widespread belief that the people killed in that incident were the victims of infrastructural failure caused by systemic corruption. Last Saturday's protests were the biggest yet. So big, in fact, that it was extremely hard for observers to keep track of numbers, and crowd estimates vary from between 100 to 300,000. And all this despite the fact that, on paper at least, many of the protesters' demands seem to have already been met, most symbolically, of course, with the resignation of the Prime Minister. So, what keeps Serbians taking to the streets? We tasked DW's Belgrade-based reporter Idro Seferi with finding out for us.
I am meeting with Marko Vuković, a DJ from Belgrade, who has been voicing his support for the ongoing protests in Serbia. I am curious to find out what drives people like him to keep protesting and why these protests are still strong after all this time.
No, people are generally dissatisfied with everything in Serbia, with, economy, politics, with healthcare, with justice, with education. It's just all piled up in one big hill of problems. It was boiling, and now it's fresh to cook, you know.
If we make it concrete, what makes you unhappy and why you go to protests?
Injustice. Simple as that. It's injustice because the justice is not the same for everybody, you know. If you have a membership card for Srpska napredna stranka, then you are free of guilt for anything that you are charged, you know. You can drive McLaren, you crash it under the cocaine, and you're free of charge. You can, I don't know, kill people, 15 people, and you're free of charge because you have a membership card. And it's so obvious. Every time I look at the news and everything, I just get mad, you know, because that's injustice. That's what it is.
But many of the protesters' demand have already been formally met. Some officials have been jailed and the prime minister has been forced to resign. So why hasn't this been enough to stop the protests? It's a question I put to Dušan Spasojević, who teaches political science at Belgrade University. We met outside of his faculty building. We students have been picketing since December.
This is a long-term process. I mean, it's now different than it was in November. I think this is fully political protest now. They are upset about everything in society, not only with the initial demands related to the fall of Konopi in Novi Sad railway station, but also I think they are more driven now by the feedback from the regime, from the response from the regime, including repression, but also ignorance and attrition. You know, every day there is something wrong from the government, from the ministry, from some of the professors, and they feel that.
You go quite enough in media, TV stations, and talk also about political solutions. How do you see that political decision or a solution that would solve these problems?
I would say that most people agree at this point in time that we need some kind of transitional government that would include maybe opposition and opposition representatives, but also university and expert communities. Opposition political parties are not well supported, and we have a general crisis of legitimacy and representation in society.
Whilst the overwhelming majority of students appear to be either actively involved in or supportive of the demonstrations, in recent weeks, pro-government TV shows have featured students saying they are fed up with the protests and want to return to their studies. Some students even build a protective barrier around the offices of the president. They did this in tandem with veterans from the Yugoslav wars, wearing the uniforms of the notorious Red Beret, which is accused of multiple war crimes, and whose members were implicated in the 2003 assassination of the Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. Meanwhile, the authorities are accusing the anti-government side of infiltration. Here is Milovan Drecun, the head of Parliamentary Commission for Defense and Internal Affairs.
We know that foreign secret services are involved, and we see some connections with individuals from these protests. Especially active is the Croatian secret service. Our security information agency succeeded at the end of last year in compromising them, discovering their collaborators group who came here claiming to be tourists. They wanted to infiltrate the protests and apply pressure.
President Vučić has also repeatedly accused foreign powers of stoking discontent. This week he claimed that the demonstrators were being bankrolled by USAID, despite the fact that the Trump regime is currently cutting USAID, and that in the past the Serbian state itself has received over $1 billion in USAID support.
Basically, they're using the narratives of Trump, Musk and Rubio about corruption within USAID.
Maja Stojanović works for the Belgrade-based Civic Initiatives. Her organization was among several NGOs confronted with the police investigation into alleged money laundering.
And now officially they are pretending to investigate corruptive activities within USAID projects. Why we know it's not the real reason is because they are actually collecting documents from the organizations that they see as enemy of the state. Enemy of the state in their perspective means the ones who are doing the transparency of the government, rule of law, democracy building and these kind of things. So we basically cover freedom of assembly as such and making sure that citizens have these basic human rights.
On Saturday, 15th of March, people from all over the country converged on Belgrade for the biggest protest yet. Near St. Mark's Church in the city center, I found Marko, the DJ, demonstrating with a group of his friends.
Days ago when we talked, you said that the biggest issue is justice. Do you think justice will be served in Serbia?
Maybe not today, but sure it's coming. I can see in the people's face and everything and the atmosphere and everything. I think it's coming. It's near, you know.
Idro Seferi for Inside Europe in Belgrade.
Anger at corruption is, as you may have noticed, a common theme in many of our stories at the moment. Are you curious to find out where your country places in the Global Corruption Index? You can find out at transparency.org. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany, currently ranking 15 out of 180, down 3 places from 2023. You're listening to Inside Europe.
The legendary escapologist Harry Houdini was obsessed with the afterlife.
I see a little boy. He is in a happy place.
Join me, Tim Harford, for a cautionary tales trilogy on the world's most famous magician and his campaign to ban mediums, a mission that would cost him friends and leave him fearing for his life.
They're going to kill me.
Listen to Cautionary Tales on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The inimitable British actress Thelma Ruby turns 100 on March 23rd. You may remember her from our Double Gold Signal award-winning Women's Day special back in March 2023, when she regaled us with tales of entertaining wounded World War II soldiers and starring on stage alongside the likes of Orson Welles and Judi Dench. Well, Thelma is still going strong, but lately she has swapped acting for activism. So, what's going on? Well, after seeing a viral video of Thelma in this latest of incarnations, Danny Mitzman decided that it was high time to check back in with her.
Pink lipstick and matching nails, an ever-present twinkle in her eyes, and an irresistibly infectious laugh. We're in Thelma's apartment overlooking Wimbledon Park, and we've been joined by her new fellow activist friend, Susan Cusack, who's visiting for the first time.
My husband is also Irish.
But it's nothing to do with the acting family, you say.
There is a small connection, because there's not that many Cusacks.
And I said to you before,
Thelma Ruby may have retired from stage and screen, but she's still using her voice and charisma for other things, like her latest project, fighting to prevent the transformation of her beloved Wimbledon Park from an open green space into a massive tennis development.
The London Eye.
Yeah, you can see the city over there. So,
good Lord, so you're seeing, we can see all the way to the city.
I've been in this flat since 1993. That's more than 30 years. And it was, of course, because of the view. I completely rebuilt it.
You've got a living room area and the kitchen table overlooking the spectacular view. You're on the top floor.
Exactly. Exactly. It was designed by Capability Brown. He's the most famous landscape gardener that this country's ever had. And he did it mostly with sweeping lawns and trees and lakes.
So every day, this is what you wake up and have your breakfast to?
Not only every day, but all through the day, because at my age, I don't go out so much. So every day, several times a day, I get my spiritual uplift, and I do really feel happy every time I look out of this, knowing how lucky I am to have this wonderful view.
Which is why, at the age of nearly 100, Thelma the actress has relaunched herself as Thelma the activist.
After plans to build dozens of new tennis courts and a stadium on Wimbledon Park were approved, a local 99-year-old woman says she'll chain herself to a tree to stop the development going ahead.
The All England Club has got permission to build 39 new tennis courts and an
Stadium. I didn't know that was
on. That must have been on the Saturday evening news at 6 o'clock.
So, Thelma, what exactly is going on?
There is an evil plan by the Wimbledon Tennis, the All England Tennis, to desecrate a magnificent landscape that I see from my window. They're going to cut down hundreds of trees. They're going to dig up the turf. They're going to build 38 tennis courts and to build an 8,000-seat show court. Can you imagine? Can you imagine cutting down, in this day and age, hundreds of trees? They admit to 300, but people have told us that it's more like 800.
The £200 million expansion project's got Thelma, Susan and a swathe of the local community up in arms.
I can tell you that the community is very firmly against this planning application. If you were to take a tour of the ward today, you would see many Save Wimbledon Park posters in windows.
It's a dangerous London-wide and national precedent for development on the Greenbelt, and it means permanent loss of this park for us.
The All England Club said, for the avoidance of doubt, any future proposals will be delivered in partnership with the local community.
We need these green spaces to allow us to breathe freely, and so do the local wildlife.
Some of the MPs, councillors and campaigners speaking out against the proposals at a Greater London Authority hearing last autumn. As chair of her local residents association, Susan was among them.
Everybody was absolutely horrified. Everything about the biodiversity, the felling of trees, it just really wasn't taken into account. And obviously you're losing all the roots in the ground for flooding and all that sort of thing. You're losing all the wildlife habitats, some of which are endangered. And this is a priority habitat.
The park straddles two London boroughs, but as only one of them approved the plans, the application was passed to the Greater London Authority.
The entire area that the All England Club proposed to develop is 73 acres. So we can see in the distance St Mary's Church spire, which always features at the beginning of the tennis. I actually live just up the road from there. But what Thelma would be looking out on, apart from after 10 years of excavating the entire site, would be looking straight at a stadium, which would be on the opposite side of the road to court number one.
Nevertheless, the GLA's planning officers have recommended granting conditional planning permission.
However, we're fighting it. We haven't given up hope.
I've actually chosen the tree, and I'm going to chain myself to a tree so that one of those...
Well, there's one across the road there that has got a good trunk, that you can see all the trunk, so I can be chained to that. I've had a lot of support, people coming with soup, hot drinks, and blankets. And one friend who says they'll take over at night so I can get home and have some rest. and people who say they'll come, I really think a big crowd would come.
I'm 99, let them arrest me.
Yes. And then I thought, since then, I've spent 99 years as a law-abiding citizen. I really don't want to break the law. Because we have plans, you know, maybe during the night to saw off a bit of the railing there for us to get through. Or to break the lock in one of the entrances there. But that would be breaking the law. I can't start breaking the law when I'm nearly 100.
I don't think that's a headline we're ever going to read. But with that theatrical sparkle of hers, Susan says Thelma's proving an invaluable campaign resource.
Oh, very useful, because we are David and we're versus Goliath, and Goliath have an awful lot of money. So when we can get some amazing publicity like Thelma can give us, that's just incredible.
I'm very lucky because I'm friendly with Dame Judi Dench, and she's a great fighter for trees and nature. And I contacted her within the last few weeks and said, would she add her name to it? She said, certainly she would. Oh. Put my name among yours as those fighting this plan.
And the High Court's now granted Save Wimbledon Park permission for a judicial review, so this match isn't over yet. But despite so much anger over the All England club's actions, incredibly, it hasn't affected the way locals feel about their world-famous tournament.
Actually, I love tennis. I go every year and sit in centre court and love watching it, which is why I'm so sad that I feel this way. You know, I really hate what they're doing and think that their plan is evil, but tennis itself I love.
There'll be plenty of festivities this month as Thelma celebrates her 100th birthday with several parties and tea at the Ritz. But looking out at the view across the road, no prizes for guessing the gift she's really hoping for. Danny Mitzman for DW in Wimbledon.
Happy birthday, Thelma. Now, I really don't want to get on the wrong side of a newly minted centenarian here, but in the interests of fair play, I am going to quote the chair of the AELTC Tennis Association, who argues that this expansion is the only way to keep up with the other three Grand Slams, all of whom host qualifying on site. It's important that Wimbledon maintains its place at the pinnacle of the sport, she says. The other slams are three-week events. We are a two-week event. Game, set and match? We'll see. This week, revellers in Ireland, the United States and Irish pubs across the world marked the day of St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland. What we want to know is, where was the first St. Patrick's Day parade held? Was it A, in Dublin, B, in Boston, C, in Cork, or D, in Chicago? Congratulations to everyone last week who guessed that the indigenous Inuit name for Greenland translates as land of the people. There's a message in there somewhere. That's it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Sam Baker and sound engineers Jürgen Kuhn, Gerd Georgi and Thomas Schmidt. Our feedback address is inside-europe@dw.com. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.